This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we're going to talk to Jane Corey. She has written a book called My Husband's Wife. It is published by Pamela Dornan Books. It will be out in the United States on January 31st, and she's here to talk about it. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
It's cold. It's very cold here in Pennsylvania, so I'm freezing.
What sort of temperature is it?
Oh, I think it's about...
It's probably beaded over here.
It's probably about 25 out, maybe. Maybe a little warmer. It's going to get warmer later in the week.
10 degrees here. 10 degrees in the UK, so I think I'll swap you.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yes. No, it's quite cold. I've just been for a brisk winter walk with my dog.
Let's talk about this book. You've had some experiences in prisons writing this book.
And
I'm just amazed at what you've been through to write this book. And the book is so interesting. I mean, I just found myself reading it very, very, very slowly for some reason. I guess maybe I wanted to savor each little part.
Oh, that's a great compliment. Thank you.
But tell me about working in a prison. I mean, this is, you worked for a couple of days a week in a prison? Is that the way it worked?
I worked for 2 days a week for 3 years as a writer in residence of a high security male prison in the UK. And I did it after my first marriage ended. Until then, I'd been a full-time journalist on a woman's magazine. And when my first marriage ended, I found myself in need of adding to my income on top of my maintenance. So I saw this job advertised, and I didn't want it, to be honest. I was really quite scared, but the money that they were offering was exactly what I needed. And I applied for the job, rather hoping that I wouldn't get it, because the thought of working in a prison where men had committed some very bad crimes, like murder and rape, and where there were also, I knew, a high proportion of psychopaths, I was really frightened about it. And I got an interview and thought, well, I probably won't get it because I don't have any experience of prisons. And then when they offered it to me, I was quite shocked, and I almost thought twice about taking it. But then I spoke to my sister, who said, what a crazy idea.
So
I thought, actually, I'm going to do it. I did.
you made me do it. Your own sister.
Absolutely.
But I would imagine you probably got spit on or cursed at or any kinds of...
Well, you know, when I started, I assumed that there would be an officer with me all the time. And in fact, it didn't work that way. I conducted workshops and one-to-ones without any prison officer. The nearest prison officer would be down the corridor, quite some way away, maybe a 10-minute walk in the office. The only protection I had were keys around my belt and a whistle. And I'd had a brief chat, an induction chat, and I was told that under no circumstances must I ever leave those keys around so that somebody could get them. I was also told there was a risk of being taken hostage and that I had to make sure that I tried to keep these keys on me so that wouldn't happen. All of which, as you can imagine, quite unnerved me. But then when I started doing what I was meant to be doing, which was to help men write poems, write their life stories, write their novels, I sort of forgot that they were criminals, because the written word is a great leveler, and people who came to me genuinely wanted to. I wasn't part of an education syllabus where they had to come. People came to me because they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely wanted to help them write their life stories, and they wanted to write them too. And I would enter my men's work for awards, and some of them got some very high, some very prestigious awards. And so I sort of forgot what they did, and then every now and then it would come out, and they'd mention that they'd murdered somebody or that they'd raped somebody, and then you would see them in a different light. It was very hard not to, so I always wished that they wouldn't, actually.
Did they ever ask you to bring something in for them?
No, they didn't. I did, on occasion, find myself very spooked out by one particular man who stalked me. And at first, it wasn't obvious that he was stalking me. He kept asking me advice about his book. And in the particular part of prison that I was working in, well, in the part that he belonged to, you could move around fairly freely. And so I'd find him outside my office continually, almost like a child at the end of class. And I looked up his crime, which was something I very rarely did. I literally just Googled his name. And when I found out what he did, and I won't tell you, it's not very nice, I got quite scared and I made sure that I was never alone with him again. I always ensured that if I saw him to get
they would make some nasty comments to you, I'm sure.
Sometimes they did, yes, and I did have some people who made sexual innuendos, and then there'd be other people in the group who would put them down and say, no, don't do that.
That's when you say to them, if you don't watch it, I'll put you in my book and kill you.
Well, no, I didn't do that. I did have some people swearing at me. One particular man got very cross with me because it was a lovely, warm day and he wanted to have a class outside. And I said, no, that wasn't allowed. And so he did curse and swear. And we had a bit of time out. And then in the afternoon, he kind of knocked on my door and said, I'm really sorry. And I said, that's fine. Sometimes we all say things we shouldn't do. But there was a leap of faith, I think, because one day the room that I usually used wasn't available, and the men said, well, you can come and run the workshop upstairs near our pads, which was the prison word, prison speak for bedrooms. And I said, well, I'm not actually allowed in that part of the prison. And they said, well, can't you ask permission? So I went to the officers who were down the corridor, and I thought they'd say, no, it's not allowed. And they said, well, it's up to you, Jane, if you want to. So that put me in a rather tricky predicament, because I'd known these men for about a year. And if I'd said to them, no, I'm not going to do it, they'd know I didn't trust them. And if I said yes, and they attacked me, then the headlines would make me out to be a very naive, rather silly woman. But actually, I took a leap of faith, and I said yes, I would do it. And as I climbed the stairs towards the room where we were going to hold this class near their bedrooms, I did get quite nervous, but in fact, it was absolutely fine.
So you spend about 11 hours a day in, for 2 days a week.
Yeah, for 3 years.
I can't even imagine the terror you must have felt at some point.
Well, you know, I used to get very nervous in between those days when I was on the out, as it were, when I was living my ordinary life, writing and running courses and looking after my children. I would get very nervous about the thought of going in the next day or the day after. But when I got there, when I started my day, I forgot to be nervous. But then when I would come out of the prison at the end of the day, I'd feel this huge sense of relief that I was still in one piece and absolute exhaustion. And this was something that I tried to put into my book, because in my book, the heroine is a lawyer who's asked to defend a man who's accused of murder. And this man, Joe, is a very intelligent criminal. And I came across many intelligent men there, criminals who didn't look like criminals. And that's what I wanted to get across in my husband's life.
So nobody you met was really based on Joe at all?
No, he is an amalgamation of many people. What he does reflect, as I said just now, is the fact that some criminals can be very intelligent, very well-spoken, and very well-educated. But it also deals with the relationship between first and second wives. I can't say exactly how, because it might give the plot away.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
But after my first marriage ended, I was on my own for 3 years, and then I married a man whom I'd known all my life, actually. In fact, I met him 4 weeks before my first marriage, and he'd remained a family friend, and I married him, and we've been happily married now for a few years. But it made me think about the relationship between first and second wives, mm-hmm. and hence the title, My Husband's Wife.
Exactly. Now, tell me about these little italics in the beginning of some of the chapters. Somebody might be a little confused about what they are. It starts off with the prologue and goes through the book. Explain what they are and what they mean.
The book starts with a newspaper cutting showing that somebody has been murdered. And you know his name, you know a little bit about him, and then the book goes back some years. So as you're beginning, you know that in the future, somebody is going to be dead. One of the characters you're reading about is going to be dead. And every now and then, as you say, there are short italics, and they are written in the first person from somebody who's clearly in danger. And because they're in the first person, you don't know who it is. You don't know what danger they're in. You don't know why. But as begin to guess. I hope you begin to guess. There are certainly clues. And the idea is that it not only, hopefully, heightens the tension, but it also tells you something about the characters you're reading about.
So we have Lily and Ed and Carla, and then there's Joe in the background who's up to, or is he up to anything?
Well, that's it. I mean,
who can we trust in this book? That's the whole thing. Who can we fully trust? We start to learn things, and then we're like, well, I don't know. So, I mean, I found myself loving the characters and then hating them at some point, too. So things would happen.
That was partly the plan, because basically the premise in my head was that none of us are all good or all bad. We each have a bit of good and a bit of bad in all of us. And Lily is the heroine, one of the heroines, who is a lawyer, who defends this man, Joe. And Joe is a very cunning, clever, manipulative man, but he has good bits in him as well. He's a very loyal man in his own way. And then, of course, there's Carla, who starts off as a child. And when you and I were talking before the interview, you said to me that Carla seemed like a very opportunist child. Opportunistic child. And that's right. She is, in a way,
she's using people around her. Yeah, she uses people around her.
But there's an excuse for her, because she has a very manipulative mother who is desperately trying to carve out a life for herself as a single mother with her child. Mm-hmm. And she does things that perhaps she shouldn't do. And her daughter learns this at her knee. I had many men in prison who learned how to break the law at their mother's knee. And Carla doesn't necessarily break the law, but she does things that aren't perhaps right. And she does this because her mother has set an example.
Exactly. And she's a piece of work.
I hope that we feel sorry for her, because we can understand why she might do it. She learns.
Well, that's the thing reading this book. I read it very slowly, and I found myself enjoying seeing what was going to happen next. And you're very good with confrontations on characters. I really enjoy that. I mean, what's going to happen when one person finds out something about another? And I like that. I like that confrontational dialogue that's so interesting to read, you know. And I found myself feeling sorry for some of them, and then feeling angry at some of the others. And who am I supposed to like, and who do I not like in this book?
but that's actually often part of real life, I think. And in a way, this goes back to my career as a journalist, because after university, I became a journalist, and I still am. I write a column for the Daily Telegraph, and about being a granny, and because I'm a fairly young granny, so I
very, very young granny, you must say, very young,
very young granny. Thank you. And so when I was a journalist writing for women's magazines and also the Times and Telegraph, I would often do what we call top stories, triumph over tragedies, and I would interview people who lived ordinary lives, but somehow dealt with a big thing that life dealt them, and so they managed to get over the tragedies in their life. And it taught me a lot about characters. It taught me how people tick. It taught me how we all have different parts, different personalities, and I'm sure that was very important in building up the characters in my fiction.
Now, your book was very popular in the UK last year, and it's coming out January 31st this year.
I was very lucky.
The question is, will the American people like it as much as the British people? I think they will, because I think it's a fascinating character study. I mean, it's almost like you almost feel like you know a lot about psychology, because the psychology of this book is interesting. Did you consult with a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
I interviewed some psychologists, but actually, as a journalist, I was used to interviewing psychologists over the years, and as I said, I'm always interested in how people work and how their minds work. And in fact, you were just talking about how it would be received in the States. I'm really excited, because the Washington Post gave it a wonderful review yesterday, and very exciting on the front page of the arts pages. And in the UK, I feel slightly embarrassed, it's very exciting for me. In the UK, it became a Sunday Times bestseller. So I'm still pinching myself.
What did Sean think about you going to the prison?
Well, Sean is my husband, in case people don't know, he's my husband. when I went to the prison, I wasn't married to him then. He was still just a friend.
Right.
And in fact, he was very supportive of it, which which endeared me even more towards him, because he said he thought that was a great thing to do. And
are you a risk taker?
I probably am, you know. I tend to do things, if people say I shouldn't do them, I do tend to do them. It's a bit naughty. But I'm
Are you trying to prove yourself?
I think that when you find yourself on your own after a long marriage, you need to prove yourself, you need to be strong, and you have to be brave for your children, and if you don't have children, you have to be brave too for yourself. I needed to do this job financially. It was essential because it would provide a regular monthly income, and I knew then that I would be able to pay my mortgage. But I also wanted to do it for myself. I wanted to prove that I could do it.
Well, how hard is it to write? You know, obviously, you've being a journalist, you were faced with deadlines, and that can sometimes be even worse. On deadlines in newspapers can be more stressful than deadlines on books, because at least you have maybe a year to do it, but you don't have that time frame in journalism. So how did you transform?
You know, I've always thrived on deadlines, actually. I remember at the age of 21, training as a journalist, being told that you never, ever missed a deadline. And I have never missed a work deadline in my life. It's not quite right that you have a year to write a book. Actually, normally, if you have a contract, it's less than that.
Right.
And then there are several stages of revision and editorial processes. So the whole thing might take a year. But actually, when I write, I tend to write about 2,000 words in one sitting, usually in a couple of hours. And then the next day, I will read through what I've written. I will edit it slightly. And then that will get me into the zone to write the next chapter. And then when I finish the book, I will go back and I will revise it several times, going through for plot consistency and character and time frames, and then I will send it to my agent and publisher.
So I guess by the time you finish this book, you're already on, after a year, it takes, I guess, about 9 months or a year, you said, to actually write
yes.
with everything, the rewriting and making sure everything's
yes.
perfect. You're almost on to the next book. You know, do you have a gap between books?
Well, the new book is called Blood Sisters, and it comes out at the beginning of May. And, in fact, the cover has just been revealed today, can you believe, on Twitter. And it's about sisters. It's about sisters and loves and lies.
Now, is this coming out in the UK or in the United States?
It's coming out in the UK in May.
Okay.
In the UK. And,
but I won't be able to read it, so that's no good for me.
Oh, well, you can. You can read it on Amazon.
You'll have to slip me a copy.
I will. Just give me your address.
I want to read it. No, I'm serious. I like the way you write. I like the way you write characters. When you're a reader, and I don't know how all readers feel, but I only know how I feel, the characters have to be real people. They can't be cardboard. They can't be somebody that I don't feel like I know. I have to know these characters. I have to know what motivates them. I have to have some kind of empathy for them, like you said with Carla. I have to feel something mm-hmm. for her. So if that doesn't happen, then I don't like the book. And you know,
yeah, you're quite right. Yes.
And there also has to be a character you like. You can't hate every character, because then it's like, well, what's the point of reading the book?
No, I agree with you. I need to like a character. I try to make people root for them, to want them to win their particular battle. But at the same time, they need to have flaws, because a perfect person is not really a proper person. We all have flaws in us.
Right.
And so I want them to have errors which could do with improving, just as I do and everybody does. But when I think about my characters before I start writing, I want to give them a problem, but I need to give them a reason for that problem, and I need to think about their background and where they grew up and who their friends were, whether they like, what kind of food they like, whether they like curries, whether they're vegetarian, what kind of films they like. It all builds up into a particular person, and I don't sit down and draw a list. I sort of let it cook in my head, so that when I'm walking the dog, or when I'm playing tennis, or when I'm swimming, because although I live in a cold country, I live by the sea, and I swim in the sea for quite a large part of the year, and it helps me to think, and I build up the characters in my head that way.
Interesting. Now, you have three kids. What do they think about your writing? Do they read your books?
Oh, they're wonderful. They do. I actually get a bit nervous about my family reading my books.
Why? What are you afraid of?
because they often make the mistake that many people do of thinking that a character is based on one particular person.
They start to look for themselves.
And if it's not, they start to look for themselves. They're wonderful. They all say they're very proud of me, which is very kind. Two of them write themselves. One is a journalist, and the other isn't quite published yet.
So it runs in the family.
Novels. Yes, absolutely. And the third is a teacher, so she helps people to write. And so, yes, it is strange, though, when friends and family read your book. It's a bit like getting undressed in front of them. You sort of feel a little bit nervous and apprehensive. And I have had friends who come up to me and say, Jane, you seem like such a nice, quiet person. You know, I'm a bit surprised you wrote such a dark book. But actually, appearances can be deceptive.
And then you think to yourself, oh, boy, do they think I'm a really dark, disturbing person?
Yes, but the thing is that the book itself isn't completely dark and disturbing. There are dark and disturbing elements.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But they are normal people in my book who are stretched to the limits by extraordinary things that happen to them. And that's something that can occur to any of us. If we are put in a difficult situation, we might react in a way that we might not expect ourselves to react.
Exactly. And that's
what happens to my character.
And that's what, when you're reading the book, you're seeing all these different characters and how they react to different situations. Sometimes very extreme situations, and you know, even though it starts, and that's the thing, it builds up. In the beginning, everything's pretty normal. And then all of a sudden you find out it's not as normal as you thought it was. And
that's what I enjoy doing, a slightly slow burn to begin with, just, you know, maybe for a chapter or so, and then you're sort of sucked into it. You're seduced into thinking, oh, you know, this is a kind of normal situation, because it starts with a young married couple beginning their married life, and she's off to prison on the first day of after they come back from their honeymoon, and he's a would-be artist, and he's working for an advertising agency and doesn't really enjoy it, and they're in a little flat in London which is too small for them, and they go off to work, and then you begin to learn that actually they didn't know each other for very long before they got married, and that things aren't quite right, and then you find out that there's this mother, single mother with her daughter called Carla, who live in the same block of flats. And then it begins to build and build.
Right. Now, the cover here, this woman facing the hedge, I find this interesting, fascinating. You pick up the book and you think, I wonder what that's all about. Who is this woman? Why is she facing the hedge? And it says across the top, an eye for an eye, a wife for a wife. Very interesting.
Well, as I said earlier, it's also about the relationship between first and second wives. I mean, I actually get on very well with my first husband's wife, and this is not based on our relationship, but it did make me think about what might happen if a second wife had to ask a really big favor from a first wife. Now, I'm not going to tell you how that fits into the plot, because it might spoil the surprise, but that is part of it.
Absolutely. And we wonder who this girl is on the cover, and where's it going? Which character, right away our mind goes to, I wonder which character she is. Is she one of the characters in the book?
Who do you think it might be?
Well, I immediately think it's Carla, but then, I mean, it just seems like what I picture Carla looking like, but even though I can't see her face, and that's another thing, she's in red. And it's interesting that she's dressed in a red sweater or blouse, whatever it is, and indicating blood.
Well, I'm not giving away anything, because...
I'm surmising, you know. You can't. That's the trouble with the thriller. You really can't give too much away, or people will say you have to say spoiler alert. You know, and
exactly. But the feedback that I've had from people is that they've liked the fact that they're not quite sure what's going to happen, that it's kept them on their toes, but at the same time they can believe in the characters, which really pleases me, because that's what I wanted to try and do.
Well, the characters, like I said, the characters have to be believable. The characters have to feel like you can identify with the characters. You have to feel like, you know, what they're saying is interesting, and you want to hear what they have to say. I mean, a lot of books you read and there's a lot of description. It's just full of description, and after a while the description just wears you down.
I like books where things happen, and there is a time and a place for description, certainly. You need to be able to feel where you are, but I agree with you. For me, that's not enough. I need a character with a problem in a sticky situation. I need to be able to root for that character, and I need to be with them as they go through their problems and solve one problem and then find they have another.
Is it tougher to write novels than it was to be a journalist, though, in general?
Two such completely different techniques. The tough thing about being a journalist when you're writing an article is finding the case histories. So, finding people that fit in. If you have to write a piece about, say, somebody who's starting life again after a marriage breakup, you need to find case histories to interview. The beauty about writing a novel is that you just write what's in your head, and that when you need to do some research, you can ring someone up and say, could I come and spend some time with you? I don't need to mention your name. It's just for research, and they're very happy about that. It's a completely different discipline when you're writing a novel, in that it's a longer term project. So it's another world that you put yourself in. You live in another world for 6 to 9 months or a year, and it's not like a feature, an article, where you write it, you dash it off, and then you're on to the next thing. So they both have their own challenges, and they both have their own joys.
So my husband's wife, and the new one's called, you said, Blood Sisters? Was that
Blood Sisters, yes.
Were they equally as difficult to write, or harder to write than the other?
You know, I don't actually see them as being hard to write, because it was just what I was doing, like breathing. And
it's that easy?
I wouldn't say it's easy either. I didn't see it as a chore. It certainly wasn't a piece of cake, but it's just something that came out of my head and out of my mouth almost without me knowing I was doing it. Yeats used to talk about automatic writing, about words just coming out on the page without him being aware of it. And that's how it's always been for me ever since I was quite little, because I have been writing stories and poems ever since I was 3 or 4 years old. And it just comes out.
We were talking about compassion before, and I was watching last night about a fawn that got stuck in a grate, and a kid heard the fawn crying out for its mother, and they had to call the police and get the fawn. But it had a happy ending, and I found myself crying because I could sympathize with that poor fawn, you know, and thinking that it can't get to its mother. I mean, what would happen if we couldn't get to our mother? I mean, it would just tear us apart.
It tugs at the heartstrings, doesn't it? And that's actually the root of characterization. You want something that tugs at the heartstrings. You want someone to be, as a novelist, you want someone to be divided from the person they want to be with, so that you can pluck the reader's heart, and then you hopefully want to bring them back together again. But certainly when you were describing that, it made me think of the book My Friend Flicker, which was one of my favourite books as a child,
yes.
And also Bambi. And my mother used to say it was the first film she took me to, and she had to take me
isn't
out
it interesting
cried
that,
so much.
Right, isn't it interesting that these movies where animals die, it just really tear us apart inside, and we never really recover from them.
No, it still hurts. Absolutely, you're quite right.
And, I mean,
again,
and people would say, well, it's, as my father used to say, it's just an animal. I don't know why you want to have an animal. They just die anyway. You know, that's my father used to say. It was a horrible thing to say.
But as a novelist, what you want to do is create that, with human relationships too, so that the reader desperately wants these two people to be brought together or to make up or to do something. And it's your job to put obstacles in their path, and yet at the same time to make sure everything either comes right at the end or there's some kind of a resolution.
Now, Pamela Dornan, she actually edited your book. Did she have
how many
books does she put out a year? I mean, does she have
I'm not sure, to be honest, but I do know that she has an excellent name. She was a wonderful editor, and her colleague, Jeremy Orton, also marvellous. They're a fantastic team, marvellous team, and I really enjoyed working with them.
So when you first handed in your manuscript, I almost said manifest, I have no idea why, manuscript is what I meant to say. When you first handed it in, were there things that, would they give you like a list of things that needed to be changed?
Well, what happens is it went through my agent, and when you when an editor takes you on, they then send you a list of editorial notes. And one of the interesting things here were that there was some English idioms, as we call them, or phrases, which wouldn't have made so much sense to American authors, which to American readers, which needed to be changed. So one that I particularly remember was I had a character who didn't twig something. And in England, if we don't twig, it means we don't realise something or we don't know something.
Mm.
And that had to be changed because it isn't something that you necessarily say over there. So it was quite an education. And we had a few laughs about that.
I'm fascinated by the fact that the agencies at first are the agents trained in good manuscripts. In other words, do they know it by looking at it that it's something really special?
Well, the way it works in the UK is that you are taken on by an agent, which can be more difficult sometimes than finding a publisher. And then my agent sold it to Penguin in the UK, and then they sold it to Penguin and Pamela Dorman in the USA. So, but this process can be different. That's how it worked with me.
Right, exactly. It fascinates me that, I guess, well, you have a literary agent, and you're talking about the literary
that's
agent.
Right.
That's the one you send it to. So they must have some experience in reading manuscripts.
Yes, they do. My literary agent used to be an editor herself, and so she has a good eye. I was very lucky in that I started writing this book without realizing it was the beginning of a new genre. I just wanted to write the story. I didn't know that psychological suspense was going to be so popular. And it happened
right.
that my literary agent was looking for a psychological suspense, so she took it on, and then the rest, as they say, was history.
Yeah,
but as I said, I do think luck plays its part, because I wasn't intentionally writing something to fit in with what has become a wave, a new genre, rather like Arga Sagas were a few years ago. I was writing a story that I wanted to write about love, marriage, and murder.
Mm-hmm.
And
of course, you even wrote this book before Girl on the Train came out, which was such a phenomenal success.
I did write it before that.
It makes you wonder, well, what makes the book so special that everybody would want to read that book? And yet there are other books that are equally as good that people just don't read.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, that's very true. Well, I think it's a mixture of things. I do think characterization is important, and plot and twist, but I think timing is hugely crucial. It depends when a book arrives on someone's desk sometimes, and whether it appeals to that particular person. There are so many different elements.
Did you ever have any rejections at all?
Oh, yes, like many people. I mean, I have a friend who's a well-known writer. I won't give you her name, but she said she became an overnight success after 8 years. And that's what many of us feel.
Maybe you could just give us our initials.
No, I wouldn't do that. I'm very loyal.
Well, now I'm very curious, though. You got me very curious, though, too. It's like telling somebody, I'm going to tell you a secret, and then you don't tell them. You know?
Well, there we go.
Maybe she'll end up in one of your books, you know? Who knows?
No, I don't think so.
Maybe elements of her, you know?
The thing is, though, I think what she said contains so much truth that many writers...
Autobiographical, yeah.
Well, not necessarily biographical, but many writers write books and they don't work, or they're not published, and then suddenly something happens. It clicks, it works with the market as it happens to be, and then it happens. So I think the title, My Husband's Wife, made a big difference, because it makes you think, My Husband's Wife, well, how does that work? And then, as one of my readers said to me, love, marriage, and murder, what's the difference? So, you know, it does cover elements that people are interested in.
And that's an interesting point when you bring up, I mean, everybody who's been married, I would assume a great deal of them, you get... There's always a point in your marriage where you get angry with the other person, and you just beyond anger. I mean, that's mm-hmm. normal. That's going to happen
mm-hmm.
because
you
always have the different things, the differing opinions a lot of times, and it's
absolutely
it's very difficult not to get angry at your wife or husband. I mean, that's almost normal. It's hard. Sorry to say, but it is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just
true.
I mean, marriage is ups and downs. You don't have all the ups. You have to have downs. I think you would have to have a down, unless if you don't have a down, it's kind of creepy. If you always get along,
you do get some. Sorry, I was going to say you do get some people who say they never have arguments, but I agree with you. I think that is a little creepy. I think that it's good to clear the air.
But then then you wonder if they don't have any arguments, they're keeping it all in.
I know.
And who wants to think that? I mean, it's building up over the years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you become Norman Bates.
Well, my husband, my newish husband, as I call him, and I usually say what we mean to each other, but we always make up, and in fact, we always understand each other. We understand each other rather uncannily, perhaps because we've known each other all our lives. And I think that it is actually really important to say what you think and not to tiptoe around somebody.
Now, you had told me that, I think when this book was out in the UK, it went to number 5 on your bestseller list?
That's right, it did. Very exciting.
Now, we have a New York Times bestseller. You have something different over in England, right? It's not the New York Times.
That's right. We have the Sunday Times.
The Sunday Times, and that's the list. Well, how long were you on the list?
I was on the list for a while, and I was on the list in the top 20 for longer as well. So I used to get a bit nervous about looking at it, to be honest, because it all felt very unreal. So my agent and publisher would do it for me, which was very sweet of them.
But now you can use that for the rest of your life, that you were on the...
I know. It's pretty exciting. It's just unreal, really. It's very exciting.
It is exciting because you've published something that people are reading and people are liking.
Well, you know, I do feel that it's... I just feel very excited and very privileged. And the other thing that means a great deal to me is that Jane Corey is my new married name, and my husband doesn't actually have children of his own. My children are his stepchildren, and he's also their godfather. And so he says, you know, it's a lovely feeling to know that his name will carry on bookshelves too, that it will carry on even though he doesn't have children of his own.
Now,
and that means... It makes me feel good. It means I've given him something.
Exactly. I'm wondering, I'm curious whether any of the people in the prison actually have read this book.
I'm curious, too.
I mean, you didn't give it out to anybody. I guess you hadn't finished it at that point when you were working
in
the prison.
Well, I'd finished the prison by the time I wrote the book, so I don't know. I'm not sure. But I did give it to my old prison governor before it came out and said, would you mind reading this just to make sure that, you know, I haven't written something that's not correct about prison protocol or whatever. And he's a lovely man, and he very kindly read it for me, which was wonderful. And I also gave it to a couple of lawyers who are friends, and they read it too, so which was very nice.
Did they find anything wrong?
Just a couple of odd things, maybe in court procedure about
right.
You know, who speaks first and things like that. But it was just, for me, as a journalist, one's taught to check facts over and over again, so mm-hmm. I think it was probably part of that. But I do say that it's not meant to be an exact replica of court procedure, etc., because it's not a textbook, it's a novel, but I do like to be as accurate as I can.
Do you think that working in that prison helped you become a better writer?
I think it certainly made me become a better person. I think it made me realize that things aren't always as you seem, that you're not necessarily put in a situation where you can deal with it easily. So it's taught me the real world. I wouldn't say that I had a secluded, totally privileged life before, but it was a very law-abiding life, and I'm still a law-abiding person, but it's taught me how other people might think and act.
So therefore,
it's made me, going back to your original question, therefore I hope that it's made me a better writer.
That's interesting. That wasn't the reaction I expected from you, but it was, you know, that's the beauty of in asking questions. You never really know what the answer is going to be a lot of times.
Well, it was a good question. Well, what did you think I might say?
I thought you were going to say, oh, yeah, I definitely became a better writer just being around prisoners and learning things about human nature and the way men can be. I mean, it was raining men in the prison for you. You know, there were men everywhere.
Yeah, there were. It taught me a lot about myself.
Well, what did it feel like to be the only woman in that prison?
Well, I wasn't the only woman. There were some women guards, but there were
men. Okay.
A few, not many. There were certainly far more men than women. What it taught me was to get over my natural shyness, because I'm actually quite a shy person. So,
no.
I'm in a situation. Well, yes, it's true. It is actually true. And So in the morning, I would put on the same three things. I would put on a pair of trousers. I never wore a skirt. I put on a pair of trousers. I would put on my Chanel No. 5, because I've always worn Chanel No. 5 since I was 15. And I would put on a smile. And I made myself smile, because if I went in looking as scared as I felt inside, the men would sense that, and that wouldn't be good. So those were my three crucial items.
Do they really ask you all these questions? Sugar, sellotape, crisps, sharp instruments?
Yes.
Implements?
Yes.
That's really what they ask when you're...
Well, the crisps was a bit of an in-joke, because one day, when I was in my little office, the door knocked, and two prison officers were standing there, and they said, "We'd like to search you. Now, you're searched when you come into the prison every morning." And they said, "I'd like to look at you, the bags that you brought in this morning." Well, I'd brought in some books, and I brought in my packed lunch, which included some sandwiches and some crisps. And they said, "Do you have any other crisps?" And I said, "No, I've just got one packet of crisps." I said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, we heard that you'd brought in several, and we thought you might use them to bribe the prisoners." And I said, "Well, no, I haven't. You can see I've just got one packet." And I was a little bit peeved, actually, and I got in touch with the governor and told him what had happened. And in fact, he said, this was unusual. And but somebody had thought that I was bringing crisps to bribe people. And, you know, prison guards do have to be on the lookout for staff that behave in ways that they shouldn't. And I hadn't been, but they thought that I had. Sometimes I found that I had to get staff on my side, as it were, because there were one or two people who thought, why should this woman come in as a writer trying to help men who'd committed terrible crimes? And I can see their point. One morning I came in and I'd had quite a tricky night with my 15-year-old who'd been out late at night, and I was looking a bit shattered. And this woman, when I signed in, because you have to sign in every morning, said, "Oh, you look terrible." And I said, "Well, thank you. I've been up all night trying to, you know, waiting for my 15-year-old to come back and finding out where he was, and he shouldn't have been out, etc." And she said, "Say no more." And from that day, she was so nice to me. So it was just a question, perhaps, of showing them.
Women bonding.
Women bonding, absolutely.
There's a male term for that. It's called bromance. But what do you call women?
I'm not sure.
There is no term for it. They haven't made up a term yet.
There probably is a term. Yes, women banding together. But it doesn't always happen. So, but as I said, after that, she was very nice to me.
That's great. I mean, I'm sure you could go on and on about stories from the prison, things that happened.
I've got many. Yes, and some really sad ones. I mean, one particular day I went in and there was this terrible hushed air in the prison, and it turned out that the day before one of the prisoners had murdered another one, and neither had actually been my students, but it was an awful feeling, and it really challenged your emotions, because both men were murderers in their own right, and one had then murdered another, and it makes you think, should I feel sorry for the murderer? You feel sorry. Of course you feel sorry, but you also think about the families that they had destroyed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The people. Yeah, it's very important to think, it's all very well trying to help people, but they had destroyed other people's lives. It really challenged emotions.
So can we expect Blood Sisters to be in the United States by this time next year, do you think?
I would hope so, yes, or very soon.
So how many books does Penguin want from you? Have you signed for a certain number of books already? Or?
Well, my agent is just renewing the contract with Penguin UK for a third book, and I have the plot all plotted out, and I'm just about to start
next
week. So I'm a journalist.
That's right, you have to have all these ideas. But how do you know, I mean, when you get an idea, how do you know an idea can be the basis for a book? And how do you know if it's just an idea that isn't going to pan out? Do you know the difference?
I get a tingle. I get a tingle down my spine.
Really?
And I find that the characters haunt me, that I begin to think about them over and over again, that they start to take over my life. And I start to write myself little notes, and this is something that really amuses my husband, I'll leave myself a message on the landline at home. And it's a very good way of writing down notes if you haven't got a pen or paper to hand. And I will start to layer it. It's a bit like a pastry. You know, these pastries with layers, we call them mille feuilles. series in the UK, and I will start to think about how a character might do this, or they might do that, or they might like this, or that they might not like that, and how that might affect the plot. And so the characters begin to take me over, and then I know, I hope, that I've got something.
What's your biggest fear?
Oh, gosh, my biggest fear, I suppose, might be that my agent or publisher might not like something that I've written.
Mm. Which is always a possibility, let's face it.
Which is always a possibility. But, you know, the thing is that as a writer, you start by writing the story for yourself. It's your story, it's your world.
Well, have you ever written most of a book and then had somebody turn it down, you had to start all over again? Has that ever happened to you?
Well, I have had books, yes, that haven't got anywhere, and that's a really hard thing to accept. And then you think, oh, do I really want to go through that all over again? It reminds me of the time when I was trying to get pregnant, right in the early days, and you think, oh, it hasn't worked, you know, this is hard, but then you start again because something inside you makes you just have to do it. It's a bit like breathing. And so you do.
So what kind of work does your husband do?
Well, he took early retirement, actually, but he used to be a lawyer.
Oh, okay.
And so, which is quite funny in one way, because when I told the men in the prison, or the staff in the prison, that I was getting married again, because I got married in my last year at the prison, one of the prison officers was very cross with me because I was marrying a man who had just finished working as a criminal defense lawyer. And he was a prison officer who was not happy about that because he saw defense lawyers as lawyers who got men off, where in his view they perhaps should be jailed.
Hmm. Interesting.
So, but my husband took retirement early. He was a bachelor when I married him, which is an interesting one. So he is very good at doing the housework, and he spends time listening to music, and he does a lot of voluntary work. And we enjoy spending time together. We enjoy reading, we enjoy going for walks, and we enjoy doing things.
And he knows when to leave you alone when you need to write.
He's really good at giving me space to write. Otherwise, I wouldn't have married him.
That's right. It does come into play. I mean, they have to understand that you're a writer,
very
and writers
important.
Are writers are prone to, you know, mood swings. And, you know,
gets it. Yeah, he totally gets it. And I'll say in the evening, oh, I'm just slipping up just to finish something. I won't be long. And I come down about 3 hours later and find that it's dark and that I haven't cooked supper. And he's brilliant about it.
That's wonderful. Well, we have to let you go. This has been absolutely wonderful. Absolutely.
Lovely to talk to you.
It's been a wonderful time. The book, again, is called My Husband's Wife. It's out from Penguin, Pamela Dornan Books here in the United States on January 31st. Just in case people want to know when they can get it. It's been an absolute delight. I've really enjoyed
you. Been a delight talking to you.
And I want a copy of that Blood Sisters. I'm curious. I'm very, very serious about that. So.
We will keep in touch.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown,